This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal with our weekly recap edition. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined in studio by the producer of our show, Kerry Jr. II.
Yep, in the flesh. I'm really excited about this one. I like that we touched on kids this time, with the young people.
We talked about young people a lot this week in number of different conversations. I think you're probably referring to our conversation about social media with researcher Dana Boyd.
I am referring to that, but also we had a live conversation that's not in this recap. We had a really good live conversation about youth sports, so y'all have to go back and listen to that on the podcast.
Yeah, that we talked with David Egner, who is the president and CEO of the Ralph C. Wilson Foundation.
Right.
They locally in expanding opportunities for kids to not just participate in organized sports, but just play. And then we talk with Tom Ferry, who works with the Aspen Institute's focus on youth play, just about the national trends and how hard it is for people to find opportunities for their kids just to do the things that we did as kids, go outside and play.
A lot of like play here. When I think of kids, I think of them as kind of synonymous with fun, imagination, play. So I guess, given we do cover a lot of heavy topics, it's always nice to have the youth inspiring some lighter, I mean, not that these weren't serious topics, but lighter themes and things like that. But yes, Boyd is kind of the main one for this recap.
Yeah. So in addition to talking with Dana Boyd about social media and young people and whether there is regulation that should be considered to try to keep young people safer on social media, we're also going to talk about a lawsuit that claims local government buildings are violating the rights of people who live with disabilities by not giving them the kind of access they're supposed to have. We're also going to look back at a conversation about the cultural and historical importance of Beyoncé's new album, Cowboy Carter. But of course, we're going to start with kids and social media.
Way to tease Queen Bee there.
Right. We're not giving you that up front.
That's kind of been coloring and adding context to that conversation. So I want to give a little bit of an update before we hop into that clip. Congress members in February collected enough signatures to pass this bill called the COSA bill. It's an acronym, stands for Kids Online Safety Act. And the U.S. Senate passed that bill. This was a bipartisan bill, which is pretty big given our government usually can't agree on much of anything. But that bill, the COSA bill, would regulate social media use for kids. It requires those platforms and video game sites and messaging apps to turn on their highest privacy settings by default for users under 18. And they say that it's done to reduce the harm for the young people.
Mm-hmm.
It's received bipartisan support. And like I said, it got the number of signatures it needed to get through the Senate. It has had some opponents along the way. It was revised, and some notable opponents are the American Civil Liberties Union and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Their main concern is that the definition of harm, that could also lead to censoring content that could be interpreted politically, stuff like reproductive health and gender identity. So our guest, Dana Boyd, is also hesitant about this bill for those same reasons, and she'll explain. She explained some of that in the episode, but I think this snippet is a little bit more of a teaser for you.
Yeah, really, her position is that social media is not at the core of the problem,
right,
and that our society really is the problem, that we ought to be focusing on some of the things that are going wrong with the way kids interact with each other outside of social media as a way of fixing what happens on social media. She also thinks this bill could do more harm than good. Let's take a listen to what Dana Boyd, a technology researcher at Microsoft Research and a lecturer at Georgetown University, had to say about kids and social media. Okay, Dana, so before the break, we were talking about these modern day health concerns and what you believe is the role that social media and technology are playing in that. And I think it's fair to say that you think that they are not playing an outsized role in this, that if they're playing any role, It's an ancillary role. So I wonder what let's flip the equation here and ask about the role you believe social media, for instance, has in relationships between people and young people, and what good it does for young people. In other words, if we can say that it's not a scourge, that it's not a demon, is it an angel? Is it a thing that makes interrelations easier among young people than before?
Yeah, I should probably begin by saying that, you know, I wrote a book called It's Complicated, because that's usually my answer to everything.
Right.
It's complicated. Yeah. So, you know, the internet and social media play a couple of different roles in young people's lives, right? One of which is, let's just put it forward, is sheer entertainment. Mm-hmm. Right? I am exhausted from whatever has happened today, and I just want to be entertained. And, you know, as a latchkey kid who spent a ridiculous amount of time watching television,
right,
I can appreciate that, right? And we can talk about all the ways in which young people shouldn't be consuming so much media. But one of the things we've seen is that they have for decades. So, and certainly today's parents pretty much grew up watching TV.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's just, that is a key part of it. Whether you're sitting there watching TikTok, you know, random dances, or whether you're watching, you know, various YouTube, you know, shows that you find interesting, there's a lot of entertainment use. And then how we want to judge entertainment is to be determined. Next critical thing has to do with sociality, uh-huh. right? This is about being connected to people that you know and love. And in some cases, being connected to people who you don't know, but who share some sort of interest with you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a process by which we have to recognize the process by which we get young people to socialize in everyday life, right? When you're talking about, you know, say a four-year-old, right? Their social world is very small. It's, you know, very much controlled by their parents, and their parents' friends, and maybe their neighborhood, you know, extended family, et cetera. Once they go off into school, and of course, parents start to lose control, and young people are exposed to a much broader network of people, and that process continues on, mm-hmm. right? And of course, we think of the going off to college as like a whole world of, you know, different versions of strangers, or going off to the military, right? But, you know, again, with a shared interest. So in that process, young people, depending on their age and their stage and their interests, start to go through these different phases where they're continuing the relationships that they have in school or elsewhere, say summer camp, into the internet, and they're chatting and conversing in the same ways that they do when they gather in person, or they're starting to make connections to new people, right? And again, with each one of these, we can find pathways where things go horribly awry, right? And that, you know, is true with the internet and without the internet. Where people meet people that do them harm, or are, you know, challenging for them in different ways.
Yeah.
The next thing, you know, and I want to note that because it's also about socializing into public life.
Yeah.
So it's always, you know, I think about this like, great, you're 18. Like, now you get to vote, or, you know, go off to the military. Now what, right? Like, how did you get there?
Mm-hmm.
And what skills do you have? And so that's the other thing you see, is that this is also the place where young people start to pay attention to a broader world, whether we want to call this news, you know, and some of this is or isn't news, whether we, you know, deal with information and learning, right? And we can talk about the ways in which people shortcut that, right? Like getting, you know, ChatGPT to write an essay from them is a shortcutting of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a process by which you are exposed to information and, you know, you start to take different relationships to that. All of that is, you know, core to what, you know, is going on with the internet. I didn't mention gaming, but I should acknowledge gaming because it's a huge part of this, which is also, you know, often more in the entertainment realm of it all. And so, you know, within this, what parts of this are good or bad, right? What parts of learning are good or bad? What parts of sociality are good or bad? What aspects of, you know, entertainment are good or bad? This is a site of debate. And one of the things we end up doing with the internet is that we put it into a polarity, right? It's all good. It's all bad. That's not true. It's messy. It's yeah. mixed.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, this interesting challenge of what it means to be able to connect over time and space.
Yeah. So, but if you think about it, though, that double-edged sword that you're talking about, that's the sort of good and bad of it and the complication of it, doesn't it still cry out for a different response from us as adults because of the potential for the sort of negative reaction?
I think that there's a lot of things we can and should do as adults. Like, let's start with parents, right? As parents, we need to help young people engage with these technologies effectively. Now, the way that I started is actually start with parents' own use. So you see a parent of a, 3-month-old constantly on their phone, right? And the child is learning that the phone is more interesting than them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so one of the first advices I give to parents of small children is to verbalize every time you pick up a piece of technology. And what I mean by that is, I'm picking up the phone to order food right now. I'm picking up this phone to call your other parent. I'm picking up the phone, to get directions to where we're going. Because you're not going to sit there and be like, I'm picking up the phone to doom scroll so that I don't have to talk to you, right? So this is where, as a parent, the first thing you can do is really be attentive to your own practices.
Right, just model good behavior, right?
Oh, right, classic, right? And you can start that super young. And that's where they can see that this technology is multiple things, right? And then, of course, there's some point in this you're going to start showing a child this. And let's be honest, most American parents start showing their kids the device sheerly for entertainment,
right?
Hopefully as a distraction so that they can finish cooking or, otherwise get through their day. Well, this is the other point, is like, start having that conversation. What did you watch? How did, actually engage them about the thing so it's not a separate world, right? And this is where you start to be able to have those conversations of just like, huh, how did that make you feel? How do you think about it? This is that ability to build those muscles.
Yeah.
That is important as parents. This becomes even more important in the schools, right? Pedagogically, why am I engaging the technology in this classroom right now? Let me tell you what I'm trying to achieve so you can see my moves, right? And this is that process of reflexivity, of making things visible. That's absolutely crucial. Now, we don't do most of this, right? And so instead we get obsessed with like, well, I will, as a parent, surveil you and then see if you're consuming anything I don't like and then yell at you, even though I haven't engaged with you on anything positive.
Right.
Right. And that's a dangerous place, because what is the child going to learn there? The child's going to learn, like, I need to figure out how to not expose certain things to my parents. That's a terrible lesson, right? That's a terrible lesson. And so one of the things you want is that when children encounter something that makes them uncomfortable, which they will encounter, whether it's online or elsewhere, how do you create the conditions where they come to you and be like, that made me feel really icky, right? Like, I just saw some pop-up pornographic content that was really horrible, and I don't understand how I got there in ick. Right? Because when you start that young, you can have a much more robust conversation.
Right, right. So I also want to ask you, though, about the nature of this kind of media and how it is different from other media. And I mean, there's been a lot of research about the addictive quality of social media, and not just the inherent addictive quality, but the things that the purveyors of social media, the ones who create it and spread it around, are doing intentionally to keep people locked in to that screen. It seems to me that some of the problems that we see, especially with youth, are about the inability to walk away, to put it down, to do something else. And I think that's related to kind of the outsized role than that these social media interactions play in their lives, right? So if it's something that you can't easily walk away from, then the fact that someone is bullying you there takes on a really different role in your mind.
Yeah. So first, I think it's important to note that this is not new to this media. And one of the most fascinating sets of studies were Mihajcik's Mai's work on television and why television got you to the point where you were processing food at a rate slower than sleep. And you were like, let me stare at the TV. So let's acknowledge that this is not new. There is something very compelling about certain visual media, and the internet being another visual media and a social media on top of that. Of course, you get this as well. Now, you can argue that MTV definitely tried to do this. And we can argue that, you know, the different kinds of technology companies probably have their goals of getting you clicking and clicking and clicking. The thing that is really fascinating to me is when you center young people and you talk to them about this, they have a range of attitudes to this. But first out of almost all of their mouths is, can you get my parent to stop being addicted to this? Because the problem isn't me, it's my parent.
Right.
Which I find fascinating. And then you get into all of their various strategies. And I love some of their strategies, handing their password over to a friend during exam time so that they can't actually even log in, right? Mm-hmm. So they swap passwords. I'm like, wow, you have thought this through and how to get there. Now, I say this because trying to regulate design from like a legal place is extremely difficult
sure.
in the best of times, and we'll get there. But the thing is that what we need is young people to call it out and say, this isn't cool. I want to cut it off. We need them to be able to have the tools where they can be like, and enough. And those tools are not just technical tools. They're also social tools.
Okay, that's
and
fair.
What is notable to me about young people is that they're complaining about their parents because the parents haven't developed skills to do this. And they're certainly not teaching them. They're the ones developing the skills.
Right. So guilty as charged, first of all, right? I'm a parent who is also addicted to the screen and to social media and things like that. The difference is that I'm an adult and I'm responsible for my behavior in a different way from children and my children and people who are selling something to me or trying to get me to do something are held differently responsible than when they do with my children. Isn't that right?
But as a parent, you also get to control whether or not your children are playing with these technologies, mm-hmm. which is really notable. And they also spend, if they're in school age, a large amount of hours out of the house without these technologies in a way that you as an adult don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the question is, how do you raise healthy adults? And the question for me is like, what are the steps that get there? And the answer to me is not like you have all of these restrictions until you're 18 and then good luck, right? Because that actually breeds unhealthy adults.
Right.
So the key with me, whether it is television or whether it is TikTok, is helping people be reflexively aware and building the structures and skills. And as a parent, you get to choose how to do it at first, right? Like the answer is I'm taking away your device, mm-hmm. right? That is what happens in most households, right? And one of the funny things to me is that it usually does not involve adults taking away their devices, although most kids would like to do so, right? One of the things I often advise adults is like create a rules of the household. Right? What are the rules for everyone in the household? And get them to be constructed by everyone together. The first thing that will come up is a young person being like, I don't want the phone at dinner, dear parent. And would you not look at your phone when you're at my game? Mm-hmm. Right? These are the things they're going to point out almost immediately. So like, how do you actually go through this process and be thoughtful collectively together? And I say this because whether technology gets better or worse, and I don't have a lot of confidence in it becoming better in an advertising and corporatized way, whether it gets better or worse, you have to learn to live with the world around you. And I think that this is where we do ourselves a disservice in helping socialize young people into the process of building those resiliences.
Yeah. So that was Dana Boyd, technology researcher at Microsoft Research and a lecturer at Georgetown University, talking about why she's got real skepticism about Congress and its efforts to regulate social media.
Yeah, and I like the point that she made clarifying that she didn't think that technology was all good or all bad. It's messy. I mean, it's also kind of a generic response we have to a lot of things. Is anything all good, all bad? Kind of breaking the nuance. But I did want to make a clarification point, too, because outside of that clip in the broader, fuller episode, she details her concerns with that bill, and then she also talks about how that bill has gone through changes. I want to outline that at the beginning of this episode, I talked about the ACLU and this Electronic Frontier Foundation. Both them and Dana Boyd both all acknowledge that the changes that this bill has made
yeah.
are better, but they still oppose it. And that's because of this duty of care provision. That's what's the that allows for kind of this vague definition of harm
right.
That can allow for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, when you're trying to regulate something that is about speech, there are real boundaries and barriers in our nation set up by the Constitution.
Right.
You know, I didn't agree with everything Dana Boyd said about the role that she thinks social media is playing or not playing, but those boundaries are really important for all of us to keep in mind and to respect. And I'm glad she focused on that for a lot of her conversation with us. All right, coming up, a discussion about accessibility in the city of Detroit. And later, we're going to talk about racial boundaries that we place on music genres and how Beyoncé's album inspired some of that. Stay with us for more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined in studio by Carrie Jr. II, the show's producer.
Sorry, I cut you off there.
Stepping on me there. That's all right.
I was going to say, I made it to the middle part of this wrap-up, but maybe now I'm going to get kicked out. I might get kicked out.
You just got to wait for me to stop talking before you start.
No big answer there.
No big deal. All right, up next, we're going to take a look at a lawsuit that claims local government buildings here in Detroit and Wayne County are violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by not making themselves accessible enough to people who live with disabilities. We've talked with an attorney who is working on the case and learned about one of the plaintiffs who has been fighting for this change for a really long time.
Yeah, we spoke with Michael Bartnick, who is the attorney. He joins us to give kind of the details of the case. And on top of that, we were joined by a familiar voice, Laura Herberg, who is a civic life reporter from Outlier Media and a former journalist here at WDET. She profiled Marguerite Maddox. Mm-hmm. Miss Maddox has cerebral palsy and is hearing impaired, but she's been a persistent advocate for accessibility for all people in the city of Detroit. So both of them joined us, and Laura detailed Miss Maddox's experience, and Bartnick talked a lot about the case. Miss Maddox is a plaintiff on the case that Bartnick is the attorney for as well.
We're going to listen to the segment of this episode when we hear from our listeners and learn more about Miss Maddox's work. Let's start today with Kathy in Madison Heights. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Last year, I went to the Madison Heights post office, and a lady was entering the building. She was using a walker, and I held the door open for her. And then when she was leaving, another lady and I held doors open for her. And I realized that there is a handicap sticker on the door, but there's not a button to push. So I filed a complaint with the post office, and they got back with me, and they said that it's not in their budget to change the door.
Ooh. So just to understand more clearly, there is a disabled sticker on the door, but there's not a way for someone who's living with disabilities to actually get through that door.
Correct. And I was there. I happened to be there yesterday, and it hasn't changed.
Wow.
I made a conscious effort to look, and the sticker is still there, but no button.
Yeah, yeah. Kathy, I'm really glad you called and gave us that example. Michael Bartnick, that is something we hear frequently from governments, both local and even apparently in this case federal, that, look, it's not affordable to make these spaces, many of which were built a long, long, long time ago, accessible. What's the right answer to governments when they say that?
Thank you, Kathy, for helping the person enter or leave that building. But the answer is that is not the right answer from the government entity, especially from the U.S. Post Office. The earliest laws were what's called the Rehab Act, mm-hmm, in the 1970s, and that specifically applied to federal buildings as well as the U.S. Post Office, and it applied to any entity that leases property to the government or the U.S. Post Office. And that law has been on the books again for nearly 50 years, and it requires the doors to be accessible. It requires the entire building to be accessible. So the fact that it is not in the budget is not an excuse. The governments are required by the regulations, the government entities, to put together a plan every 3 years to focus on the accessibility issues, to identify what the problems are, to identify what are the solutions, to identify who is going to be responsible for making those changes, to identify where the source of the funds, and to have a 3-year plan to get it done within 3 years. They've been required to do that every 3 years. Since the onset. So the post office, sometimes it is a government building, sometimes it is leased to a private entity. Mm-hmm. It is the responsibility of the post office or the entity that is the lessor, the landlord for the post office, to make those changes.
Yeah, yeah. Laura, when we think of the things that Ms. Maddox has advocated for and gotten them to do, at Detroit City Council and some other venues. I mean, money always is an issue there too, of course. She seems to have convinced them that they just need to spend it or find it.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's just, you know, having it put on your radar, first of all, and then realizing that the person who's put it on your radar isn't going to drop it until it changes. Sometimes it's an issue of prioritization. And you know, some of these things, I think, for example, one of the biggest things for Ms. Maddox right now is, sidewalk accessibility. Mm-hmm. So when we were walking along, she lives in New Center and we walked from her apartment to the queue line. It was, I think, around a mile. You know, there were several points where there was construction that had upended the sidewalk. At one point we had to walk into the road. But there were portions where we passed that were brand new cement. And she said, you know, I've been bugging City Council about that. And City Council brought it up and said, like, you know, we heard you on some of those issues and we did fix them. So I think, you know, sometimes the money is there. It's just like, we need to get to this.
Yeah. It's getting them to prioritize this over other things.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Kathy, really appreciate the call your story. Let's go next to Mary in Detroit. Mary, what's on your mind?
Well, this has been an issue that's been on my mind for many, many years. I am now 83 and was a victim of a front-end collision a good 10 years ago. So that coupled with my age makes it walking difficult. I mean, I can walk and I'm going to keep walking. But it does get hard. My solution would be on any new buildings to have an advisory group of various handicapped people. Perhaps the design would not be the big aprons that they have, and then you're going from the parking lot, then these beautifully designed walking distance from the car to the building. I mean, if people understood that for those of us that have these issues, we spend money too.
Yeah.
So if we see these things, I mean, I can't maneuver. So I will leave. I'll go somewhere else where I can get in easier.
Yeah. Mary, I really appreciate the call. And again, your perspective on all of these things. I'm really interested in the idea of having people with disabilities involved in the design and planning of facilities so that they could be at the table when some of these decisions are made about how accessible something is. That reminds me also, Michael Bartnick, of what your remedies, what your sought after remedies are in the class action lawsuit. Is it also focused on design and planning and changing, I guess, the way that we think about these things when buildings are built?
Well, yes, within the limited context of the lawsuit, we would be asking the judge, the court, to impose what's called injunctive relief, which is an order from the judge, from the court, to say to the defendants, okay, these are the problems that have been identified. I have found in favor of the plaintiffs that the evidence is there that these are the problems and that the defendants need to comply with the law, and then setting forth the schedule of the design changes that might need to be made and of the, what needs to be constructed and implemented. And then the injunctive order is ordinarily subject to the continuing jurisdiction of the court. So that, let's say it's a one-year order or a two-year order or a three-year order, a period of time in which different problems can be addressed in this particular lawsuit, then if the defendants are not complying, then the plaintiffs can bring that back to the court's attention. Mm-hmm. More generally, in terms of we need to be active citizens. So it is difficult. The building department of every city, the zoning commission, the planning commission of every city, does have public meetings and does have public documents. They're supposed to be public documents and public meetings to review upcoming projects or to review changes to projects so that the public can participate. And so, yes, Mary or other persons in the community have the right to go to those meetings mm-hmm. and to speak up about what they perceive as problems. The guidelines, the physical technical guidelines for architectural drawings and design, they state the minimum, but engineers, architects, designers, members of the public can all make it better than what's described in the guidelines. So yes, a particular guideline might say that parking space can be over here at this end of the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. But when you go out to the property, you see that that's the wrong end of the sidewalk for an accessible parking spot. It would be better to move that parking space closer to the door
someplace.
Or to put it somewhere else. And so it is very important for people to show up at these meetings to review these documents and to suggest the changes that can be made, because there are a lot of options.
Yeah, Laura, when we talk about participation and the ability to participate, there's no place I've lived other than Detroit that has more people who are more focused, I think, on showing up for meetings and being part of it. I mean, we have an entire community of people here in the city who dedicate their time to saying, look, I want to go and I want to say what is on my mind about these things, and I want to have an influence over these things. And it's kind of ironic, I guess, that participation is hindered by the physical environment. And then they have to advocate for the physical environment to change so that they can participate. But that is a big part of civic life here in the city of Detroit. And I don't want to go through the show and not kind of pause just to note how terribly critical this is to so many people who live here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of Ms. Maddoxes out there, mm-hmm. and there is a whole crew of people who regularly show up to city council meetings despite some of these physical and technical barriers. And, you know, there are people who are perfectly able-bodied who regularly show up virtually or in person to these meetings and make their voices heard. One thing that I want to relay is when I was with Ms. Maddox at the city council meeting, council member Scott Benson came over ahead of time to talk to Ms. Maddox. It was the first meeting she'd been to in person in a few months. She'd been attending virtually. And he came over and he said that he had seen a development the other day and had noticed that the sidewalks were blocked because it was under construction. And he had seen somebody out in the street with their walker. And he said, I thought of you. I thought of you. And I want you to know we're working on it. And after he walked away, she kind of squealed with joy. And I said, how do you feel? And she said, I feel proud. And I said, why? And she said, because trying to make this city more accessible for everyone, it's everybody's responsibility.
Yeah,
right. And so I think that's the important thing to remember here. And it's cool to hear on the show that there are other people who are, that's how they're living.
Yeah, that's how they think about it, and that's how they're acting.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our conversation about buildings, public buildings in Detroit and Wayne County, and whether they are doing enough to be accessible to people with disabilities. I thought that one of the most interesting parts of what our guest said was actually, it wasn't our guests. I mean, the guests were great.
The callers.
Yeah. The things that they brought up, the things that they noticed, even people who are not living with disabilities, mm-hmm. and how they kind of move through the world and notice things that are barriers and then try to move those barriers out of the way for
right.
people who would be deterred by them.
You know, I hadn't thought about, before Laura brought this point up, I hadn't thought about how parking spaces could impede bus drivers from getting to the curb and the obstacle that creates for folks trying to get on.
Right.
I know that they have the mechanisms on the bus that lower the bus and allow folks who may have like a wheelchair to roll on. When we have those parking spaces there and there's a bus stop nearby, the bus driver can't pull up to it. And I hadn't thought about that before that. So I think this was definitely an enlightening episode to really understand how accessibility works for all people too.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line,
right?
The whole thrust here on Created Equal is equality and access for everyone. This mm-hmm. wasn't just about people living with disabilities, but all kinds of people who
right.
who can't access public buildings and participate in our democracy the way they need to be able to. All right, coming up, we are going to talk about the way that we separate music by genres and by race. Why do we do that? And what does Beyoncé's new album tell us about it? Stay with us for more Created Equal.
I had to throw on that Beyonce, huh?
I had to throw on Beyonce. Gotta tease Beyonce. Back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in studio with our producer, Carrie Jr. II.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Stephen. I think it's a part that people have been waiting for, the Beyonce part.
Beyonce, I've been teasing it all hour. And look, that's a tactic, right?
Right.
Here on radio, don't put the most compelling stuff up front. Wait and get people excited
about it. Were you telling me that the conversations we've been having throughout this episode aren't the most compelling?
They're all compelling.
They're
all very important. But Beyonce is, as usual, in another category, right? If you can say Beyonce, just say the word, say mm-hmm. the name. It gets people thinking in a little different way about things. So mm-hmm. she's got this really interesting new album that I am, I don't know, three quarters of the way through, I would say, at this
still
point.
Haven't finished it.
I'm listening really carefully.
I'm
trying to listen to each track multiple times mm-hmm. because I think there's a lot going on in all of them. And that's some of what we're talking about here. An African-American woman, one of the biggest stars on the planet, decides to make an album in a genre that most people think of as white. What does that mean in America in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, well, first, I think it's interesting that you're a one song at a time listener, not a full album multiple times.
It depends.
It depends.
This is a big album, too.
That's true. It's like 27 tracks or something like
that.
That's a lot. Okay, that's fair. I can't talk. I haven't gotten through it either. But no, to that point, yes. I mean, music, I think, on a broader scale, is something I just kind of digest and want to just listen to for fun. But certain conversations, I think, are elevated when artists as big as Beyonce engage in work like this and ambitious projects like she's been doing for a while. So, I mean, we talk about her, but we had a much longer conversation. We talk a little bit about sampling and cultural appropriation, all that stuff. But the snippet that I think we're about to hear, this brief one, discuss more about, you know, black artists and white genres.
And why we perceive black artists the way we do
right.
in these genres. One of the great things about Dan Charnas, who's an author and an academic who has thought about these things for a really long time, music doesn't naturally fit into the genres that we think about them in. And race has nothing to do with that music,
how it's made.
I mean, in the purest sense, race is not the influence that we think it is on that music. We have been trained by a culture that is obsessed with race and has been from the beginning to think of music in those racial categories. I think that's a terribly important point, and it's the kind of thing that if you think about that before you listen to Beyoncé, I think you come away from the album with a really different sensibility. So we've got a kind of quick clip here of the way that black artists are perceived when they are performing in white genres. I want to start this part of the conversation in a really different space. Fast Car, the song that Tracy Chapman wrote, I believe in the 90s, was re-recorded last year by Luke Combs, who is a country artist who just loved the song and loved the idea of what he could do with it. And then the two of them performed together on stage at the Grammys this year. I thought it was this incredibly moving kind of moment that drew on all kinds of controversy and racial history and just great musical kind of connection. But I think it also rankled a lot of people. And I guess what I want to go back to here is the fact that we have been trained to believe that there is black music and there is white music, and that there are black artists and that there are white artists, and that there is that the segregation that was forced on the music industry is natural. And I thought that was such a great answer to it. That performance, of course, the recording, they were great answers to all of that. And yet we still kind of we don't have everybody on the same page. I mean, there are people who really dug into the idea that this is not the way it should be.
Yeah. I mean, look, first of all, there are a number of different nuances and distortions I think we need to untangle, right? The first is obviously you have a younger white artist who is doing a cover version of a song that was created and performed originally by this black female songwriter. Automatically, that is going to bring up this idea. I mean, I remember seeing some things on social media basically saying nobody knew about this earlier version, and suddenly this white artist is redoing it. Like, that
is
completely ahistorical. Yeah. She got a Grammy for that. She was on the cover of Spin magazine, and like, she was big. Yeah. I think the injustice, if we can call it that, is about the fact that there was no space, even in the 80s, 90s music business, for somebody like Tracy Chapman to have a sustained career as a black woman.
Right.
Right?
Right.
There was no Americana space for black women at that time. And that also, I think, has a lot to do with the legacy of Jim Crow, with rigid formatting, with a kind of way that aesthetics are narrowed in commercial spaces. So in order to be a successful black artist in the late 80s, early 1990s, you had to be New Jack Swing or hip-hop soul. There was very little institutional support, especially in black radio, right, and black media, or black-owned and operated or operated media, for somebody like Tracy Chapman. Tracy Chapman wasn't embraced on black radio. She wasn't played on black radio. It just wasn't, just in the same way that Jimi Hendrix in the 60s wasn't really embraced by the black community. And so it puts folks like Hendrix and Chapman in a position of having to rely on either white niche or mainstream outlets that do not have an ecumenical spirit, that do not have enlightenment, that do not have conceptions of blackness that are broad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is nobody did. In the very few did in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, there was nowhere for her to go.
And I think one of the things that people love about Beyoncé's album, to kind of bring it back to present day, is that she is presenting in the mainstream eye a broad conception of blackness that actually jives with reality. Mm. You know, I'm married a woman from Detroit who, black woman from Detroit, who grew up listening to Kate Bush.
Right.
Like, folks in Detroit love Kate Bush. Yep. Right. That Detroit in particular had a conception of blackness that was broad. And I think that that's what resonates, for a lot of folks who are listening to this Beyoncé album.
Okay. Dan Charnas, it was really great to have you here for this conversation. I'm going to ask you one more question. Do you like Beyoncé's new album? Are you into it? I mean, everybody I see on social media is got a review, right? An instant review. Some of them just like two or three words. But I'm curious, as somebody who knows as much about music as you do, what you think of this effort.
Oh, I do like it. I think it's brilliant. I mean, I definitely appreciate Beyoncé's genius more than, say, I return again and again to her albums or her songs as anthems, right?
Yeah.
I tend to be more of a singles person with Beyoncé. But I will say I had some slack-jawed moments listening to this album, like when Blackbird came on as the second, I'm like, what?
Right.
What? Does she have Paul McCartney chained to a radiator somewhere in the recording studio? What is going on? No, it's brilliant. She's brilliant. And I always say, look, Beyoncé actually, even beyond all this, she changed the way that, I don't want to say just women, but she changed the way vocals are sung in American music.
Yes.
She was among the first, if not the first, but certainly the most consistent example of vocalists approaching the cadences in which they sing as MCs would. Right,
yeah.
You listen to Bone Thugs and Harmony in the 1990s, and then you listen to Destiny's Child, and you understand that there's a rhythmic kind of borrowing there that completely changes the way we think of how people sing.
Yeah,
that's hugely important, and Beyoncé will always be important because of that. But just to be an artist in her level, where she could just have a residency in Vegas and ride off into the sunset. She is still doing these incredible, ambitious albums that she could very well not do, but she's doing them and brilliantly. So I guess the answer is yes, I really like the album.
Yeah.
But we still haven't talked about sampling. What's up with that?
We never got to it. We were much
See,
more
Beyoncé sucks all the oxygen out of the room.
right.
That's right. All right, Dan, great to have you here in Detroit, and great to have you on Created Equal. Next time you're actually in town, we'll have to get together.
I am so honored always to be in conversation with you all.
Thank you, Dan.
So that was Dan Charnas helping us sort through Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter album and race and culture. I learned a lot from him during this conversation about why we act the way we do with our music.
What a great anecdotal to insert in there about Tracy Chapman, Stephen. I thought that was really well done.
I think that was everything
when it
happened in terms of what happened itself, and then the reaction that you saw from some white fans, from some black fans, and from people who just didn't know all the facts about her music and why this other artist wanted to sample it.
Mm-hmm.
And what better message to send about music than to have Tracy Chapman on the stage with a country artist.
Right.
And they're both performing something that she gave the world many years ago.
Wow, fantastic. I mean, the full conversation, I think, is also really interesting to get into. Dan gives us a lot of history and context, so definitely worth listening to at WDET.org. Go ahead and listen to the full episode on Created Equal.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.